11. Development, Disarray and Discontent, 1963-1977. The exile of Ayatollah Khomeini and the Shah's success, at least for a while, in silencing the forces of opposition, generated a sense of royal self-confidence with an almost prophetic mission. The decade of 1963-1973 represented, with all its shortcomings, the best of the Shah's years, an age of economic development, success in foreign policy, and relative popularity at home. Despite repression and movements of radical dissent, for a moment the Shah seemed to have cast away the shadow of dependency on the West. Yet the sobering message of the June 1963 uprising remained largely unheard by the new ruling elite. And when it was heard, they dismissed it as the last gasp of the black reactionaries, as the Shah had labelled the clerical opposition. Expanding economy. Between 1965 and 1975, Iran's population grew by 40%, from more than 24 million to more than 34 million. Growth was facilitated by a lower infant mortality, longer life expectancy, and greater access to medical care. Rural migrants continued to move to larger cities in hopes of higher-paying jobs and a better standard of living. In 1971, Tehran's population exceeded 3 million, and by 1975, it bordered on 4 million. In 1972, there were an estimated 500,000 cars on the streets of the capital, a number that by 1979 had doubled, mostly thanks to the domestic production of an affordable sedan, the Peykan, a brand assembled since 1967 under license from a soon-to-be-defunct British car manufacturer. Not only the capital, but also all provincial centres, began to experience the unavoidable forays of the proud owners of private cars congesting urban thoroughfares. By the late 1970s, cars, vans, buses and trucks, whether domestic or foreign in manufacture, new or old, private or public, had conquered every corner of the country's rural and urban roadways, realising the worst of Orle Ahmad's West toxication nightmare. Polluting the air, especially in Tehran, where the Elbers range created a barrier that trapped the smog over the city, vehicles became one of the greatest hazards to life and safety, with escalating road accidents and fatalities. For the haves and the have-nots, cars became not only a status symbol, but also a monster demanding that all roads, even sidewalks, and all public spaces, to be sacrificed at its altar. The slogan of a TV commercial on the Iranian network, "In the hope that every Iranian can have a Peykan," summed up the consumer culture that began to take shape in the 1970s and would continue after the 1979 revolution. The state's industrialization initiative was not limited to car manufacturing and consumer goods, and often was not as present in the public mind. Throughout the 1960s and 1970s, during the third and fourth development plans, implemented by the Planning and Budget Organization, Iran expanded its infrastructure. It constructed new roads and railroads and improved existing ones, built massive dams to cultivate more lands and generate more electricity, installed a countrywide electrical grid and communication networks, water purification plants, and irrigation projects, and built heavy industry, petrochemical, cement, and sugar plants, as well as port facilities and new oil and natural gas pipelines. The private sector also contributed by expanding the capacity of spinning mills and textile plants, consumer and household goods, foodstuffs, packaging and bottling industries, motor vehicles, and even the steel industry. By the mid-1970s, Iran had developed a substantial domestic market for cars and related industries, household goods, clothing, food and drinks, furniture, and construction material, and the balance of the public and private sectors promised a viable mixed economy for a developing nation that still was heavily relying on oil revenue for its public investment. The critics of the intellectual left and later the extreme left, some still carrying the incurable Tudeh bug, belittled much of Iran's industrialization as a mere assembly, montage, of useless products that had been imposed by Western consumer culture and were for the benefit of a dependent bourgeoisie. Often looking up to the smoke-belching, inefficient, labour-intensive, centralised Soviet and Eastern European industrialisation model, such criticism later was picked up by the Islamic radicals, and became part of the rhetoric of the 1979 revolution. Yet it is fair to say that in later years, the state industrialization program became overambitious and out of control, leading to waste, corruption, and nepotism. At times, it was devoid of any meaningful relation to the state's preconceived master plan. The growth of the industrial sector barely satisfied the domestic market's growing demand for goods and services. Imports of all sorts from Europe, the United States, and Japan flooded Iran's markets, mostly at the expense of the bazaar sector and associated small-scale manufacturers and wholesalers. As the larger import-export and industrial businesses gradually moved out of the bazaar district into more fashionable areas, the bazaar's demographics began to change, especially in Tehran, but also in larger provincial centres. In due course, the bazaar came to house mostly small merchants, distributors, wholesalers, and retailers of small industries catering to the poorer and more traditional sectors of the population. The change in its function was not necessarily detrimental to the bazaar, despite the government's unfavourable attitude toward the bazaar merchants for harbouring anti-regime and particularly pro-Khomeini sentiments. Undeniably, demographic changes turned these old centres of commerce not merely into bastions of conservatism, but also into important components, financially and otherwise, of the fomenting Islamic activism. The evolving bazaar, moreover, presented a physical and geographical anomaly in the midst of the modernist image of the Pahlavi economy. The jewellers, goldsmiths, watchmakers, fabric stores, shoe stores, perfumeries, draperies, china shops, and kitchen stores, side by side with wholesale carpet merchants, import-export businessmen, bankers, moneylenders, and haberdasheries, hardware wholesalers, apothecaries, and thousands of small workshops producing a variety of goods in the sprawling neighbourhood, often in the oldest part of major cities, were still vibrant enclaves. And given their size, they were engaged in brisk business. Yet the bazaar's prosperity and what it offered, at least economically, was no longer essential to Iran's economy. The changes evident in the Iranian economy were well demonstrated by the rising oil prices and their effects on the government budget. Between 1965 and 1972, Iran's annual budget grew rapidly from nearly $1 billion to $8 billion, a sizable increase that resulted from incessant wrangling with the Iranian Oil Participants Limited, IOP, better known as the Consortium of Iranian Oil, over production levels and higher prices. The rise of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, in the 1960s, with its first Secretary General being Fouad Rouhani, 1907 to 2004, an advisor to Mossadegh and a historian of Iran's oil nationalization, gave the Shah another tool to persuade the consortium. By the mid-1960s, Iran had limited the consortium's operations to a smaller territory in Khuzestan and had signed more favorable agreements than the 1954 concession with French and other oil companies to develop Iran's offshore oil in the Persian Gulf and inland. This compelled the consortium to increase both the production level and Iran's share of the income. By 1966, there was an annual increase of 17% in Iran's income from oil, exceeding for the first time $1 billion and constituting nearly 50% of Iran's annual budget for that year. By 1969, Iran's annual production passed 1 billion barrels, and in the following year, its share of income substantially shifted from the burden of the 50-50 agreement in 1954 to the new 61% of Iran's share versus the consortium's 39%. At the time, although oil prices worldwide were extremely low, an outcome of giant oil companies' many decades of deliberate exploitation of oil-producing countries, the Iranian success appeared to be a triumph for the Shah and allowed him to come out from the shadows of the oil nationalization campaign of the 1950s. The massive oil price rises in the following years, however, proved to be not entirely a blessing, as it appeared at first glance, for they shook the Iranian economy and helped in due course to unsettle Iran's socio-political balances. The oil crisis from October 1973 to March 1974 and the multiple price increases that came in its wake was a turning point, perhaps an inevitable one, not only for Western economies and the global inflation that it triggered, but also for the economies of the Middle East and especially oil-exporting countries that relied on oil income to develop their infrastructure and raise standards of living. What was earned from oil income as it happened, at least in part, purchased affluence for these countries' privileged classes, or alternatively was squandered on vainglorious projects. Iran stood at the very top of the oil-producing countries of the Middle East, bearing the brunt of the overflowing revenues that came into its coffers. This was not merely because it was economically more developed than its neighbours, and therefore more vulnerable, or because it was the most populated of the OPEC members in the Middle East. It was because of the choices made by those in power, headed by the Shah and a small group of technocrats at his service. Choices that were enthusiastically endorsed by his foreign friends and allies, but that eventually helped undermine the very survival of the Pahlavi regime. Between 1971 and 1977, Iran's annual budget further grew sixfold from $8 billion to $48 billion, an upsurge substantially due to direct and indirect oil receipts. Shortly before the October 1973 war between Egypt and Israel that led to the Arab oil-producing exporting countries' oil embargo and triggered a rapid rise in oil prices, a barrel of Persian Gulf light crude traded at the exploitatively low price of $1.95, a price that was the outcome of many negotiations in previous years. Soon after the October war, however, the price jump stunned even the oil producers. By 1975, it had reached nearly $11 per barrel in the European spot market, and even higher prices in the United States. By not taking part in the Arab embargo against the United States, Iran stood to benefit not only financially but also politically. In contrast to the unfavourable image of Arab oil producers in Western media, which stereotyped the Arab sheikhs as greedy plunderers with undeserving riches, Iran was seen, at least by those who could differentiate Iran from its Arab neighbours, as something of a friend, still greedy and unfair, no doubt, but not hostile and uncompromising. Yet since 1972, even before the oil crisis, Iran was at the forefront of an OPEC campaign for increased prices. Initially, it was the loss of revenue due to depreciation of the US dollar that unified OPEC members in their demand for higher prices. After the United States decided in 1971 to terminate the Bretton Woods Agreement that ended the convertibility of the American currency to gold. In later years, Iran increasingly justified its price hikes by pointing at rising inflation, which hiked the prices of imported goods and domestic manufactures. It also argued that oil, a finite commodity that deserved to be conserved and fairly priced, had long been extracted to the advantage of the two powerful oil companies to supply Western economies with cheap oil. In early 1973, the situation had shifted in favour of the oil producers to the extent that the Shah, long discontent with Iran's production levels, announced that his country would not renew its operation agreement with the consortium that was due to expire in 1979. His threat found a new momentum given the long-term guarantees that the consortium required to plan its exploration and production. Concurring with the nationalization of oil industries initiated by other OPEC countries such as Iraq, the Shah felt confident enough to nullify the 1954 agreement 2 years earlier than it was due to expire. For domestic purposes, the move was portrayed as nationalization, the third one after 1933 and 1949, and a new laurel for the glory-hungry monarch. In April 1975, he flew back to his capital to be received by the crowds that had been bussed into Adia Meir Sports Stadium to express their gratitude, sepahs. Yet the exercise in imperial adulation was not without its repercussions, for the gratitude ritual took place in an atmosphere of public sarcasm and at a time when the Marxist and Islamist urban guerrilla organizations projected a very different picture of heavy-handed Pahlavi rule. The impact of increased oil income on all aspects of the Iranian economy and society cannot be exaggerated. Already in 1973, Iran was experiencing an official inflation rate of 11%, setting a pattern that was precipitated in coming years, both because massive funds were injected into a domestic economy with limited capacity, and because there was a huge inflationary trend worldwide. Although by 1973, Iranian per capita income had risen to $566, the impressive increase was diminished, if not entirely eroded, by a higher cost of living. By the late 1970s, inflation stood at as much as 25% annually. At the time, Iran's growing income from oil, as the Shah and his government were eager to point out, appeared highly beneficiary to Iran. More oil income meant a larger allocation of funds to development projects, greater affluence for all sectors of the population, stronger defences, and a greater international prestige. These were all essential ingredients for the Shah's dream of recapturing what he called the Great Civilization, Tamadone Bozorg, a catchphrase meant to recapture the glories of the ancient Iranian past. The arrival at the threshold of this great civilization, however, was imminent only to the person of the Shah and his sycophants. It was as if the rise in Iran's oil fortune and the Shah's active campaign to capture what had been denied to his deposed premier, Mossadegh, had made him see an inspired vision for reshaping his country. Mission for My Country was indeed the title he had chosen for his memoirs, first published in 1961, a mission that over the years took the shape of a prophetic call. A new technocratic elite. It is untenable to treat the Shah's evolving self-image in isolation, and especially as distinct from the new technocratic elite that came to serve the monarch and populate his government after the mid-1960s. With the appointment in 1965 of Amir Abbas Hoveydah, 1919-1979, as Prime Minister, after the assassination of Mansour, in whose government Hoveydah had served as Minister of Finance, the role of the new technocratic class became more obvious. Often younger professionals, Hoveydah was 45 when appointed Prime Minister, were mostly the fruits of a generational shift that came about in the later years of Pahlavi rule. Educated in modern schools and often holding a graduate degree from Western universities or having some experience in Europe or in the United States, they had mostly built careers after 1953, some through the bureaucratic ranks and others through family and other connections. In contrast to the landowning notables of the post-constitutional period who endured the Reza Shah era, the new class, though affluent, was not bound to large hereditary estates, particularly after land reforms. Unlike the liberal nationalists of the post-war years who supported Mossadegh, and more like the military elite of the Reza Shah era, the new class of officials was essentially non-ideological, and they seldom possessed any political agency. Though a few were from notable families or families of wealth and influence, the new generation of ministers, diplomats, and high officials relied on their education and expertise, but also on the Pahlavi patronage network, their proximity to circles of power, and obedience to the higher echelons of government. Amir Abbas Hoveydah was a case in point. Born to a family of middle-ranking notables of the late Qajar period, his father became a diplomat under Reza Shah and abandoned his own father's, Hoveydah's grandfather's, devotion to the Baha'i faith. He was brought up a secular Muslim, educated in a French lycée in Beirut, and later earned a political science degree from a Belgian university before entering the Iranian diplomatic corps. Fascinated with French literature and an admirer of André Gide, he frequented intellectual circles in Paris and Tehran and befriended the likes of Sadegh Hedayat, to whom he would send the latest works of European and American literature. An enigmatic personality, Hoveydah later joined an Iranian Freemasonry lodge, and presumably through that patronage network, he was appointed a member of the board of directors of the Iran National Oil Company. A co-founder of a circle of young progressives, which later became the nucleus for the Iran Noveen, Modern Iran Party, Hoveydah was appointed finance minister to Mansour's cabinet. Though first serving in a caretaker role as prime minister, Hoveydah's personality evidently appealed to the Shah, who retained him in office for the following 13 years, 1965 to 1977, a term of office equaled in duration only by that of Haji Mirza Agassi, who served as Mahmud Shah Qajar's premier between 1835 and 1848. Though not as influential as Agassi when it came to controlling the Shah, or as paternal, Hoveydah's interplay with the Pahlavi monarch despite his complexities, were mutually beneficial to both sides. The Shah viewed Hoveyda as unthreatening and subservient, as a humble executive who acted on behalf of the powerful ruler, a role with a long history in Iran's ministerial past. Hoveyda was prepared to play such a part while quietly expanding his network and advancing his agenda. Fearful of a prime ministerial monopoly, the Shah favoured his understated style and sycophantic passivity while playing the premier against other senior officials, notably his powerful court minister Asadullah Alam. Hoveyda, however, fully submitted to the reality of royal power, especially in the areas of security, military and foreign affairs. He was a soldier in the service of his beloved monarch, as he often asserted. That Hoveyda remained relatively unblemished by deals and wills, nepotism, and the excesses of the last years of the Pahlavi rule was in part because of his personal integrity and lack of appetite for material gains, a characteristic shared by only a few of his subordinates. This largely was because he carried a lesser burden of governance than what was expected constitutionally of the Prime Minister. It is fair to say that, more than anyone, he was responsible for the culture of ministerial passivity that prevailed through his tenure as Prime Minister. With few exceptions, a generation of officials who came to occupy high offices was perhaps best characterized by subservience to royal will, obsequious timidity, and lack of moral spine, even more so, lack of political vision. The culture of statecraft that emerged in these years accepted the Shah's ultimate authority in all affairs at the expense of critical thinking, much less voicing criticism of royal policies and practices. The atmosphere of fear and compliance spread a certain numbness throughout the system and decreased the chances of promoting independent views. A veneer of optimism about the dawning of a glorious vista opening up under the Shah's wise leadership concealed undercurrents of cynicism or opportunism. The lack of any stance independent of the Shah further weakened political agency among statesmen of the late Pahlavi era. The censorship and coercion imposed by Savak, the closure of even the pro-regime political parties such as Iran Noveen and Mardum in favour of the all-embracing Rastakhiz Resurrection Party in 1975, and the absence of any alternative political forum effectively eliminated all chances of building up a civil society outside the bounds of the state and untouched by royal wishes and whims. Although patronage networks did exist, and high officials exerted a great deal of favoritism toward their partners and protégés, there was a palpable dearth of creative thinking and even less room for political action. Despite the creation of the Rastakhiz Party, meant to boost popular participation, the gap between state actors and the general public widened throughout the 1970s. State actors operated in a sanitized bureaucratic cocoon, divorced from the realities of the society they claimed to represent. Ministerial posts became channels for doling out contracts or buying influence. The Majlis turned into an assembly of faceless non-entities rubber-stamping legislation, and, after many rounds of dismissals, the emasculated military fell even further under the Shah's spell. The small network of well-connected and compliant technocrats thus came to control and use up, if not squander, the massive oil revenues that began to pour in after 1973. In addition to Hoveyda and his cabinet members, who were routinely reshuffled, there were other networks of power and influence that included Alam and his cohorts, the entourage of Empress Farah, who received the title Shahbanu, Lady Shah, in 1967, and other members of the royal family, among whom Ashraf Pahlavi was the most visible. To varying degrees, the Shah presided over these networks of influence and favoritism, at times rebuking some for moral and financial excesses, and at other times promoting some for their merits or their loyalty. Counterbalancing rival factions proved a formidable task, one that could be achieved by allowing huge quantities of funds to lubricate the channels of power and for smooth operations of the state and its affiliated bodies and institutions. In pursuit of his earlier intellectual interests, Hoveyda also tried with moderate success to arrive at a rapprochement with discontented intellectuals, hoping to lure them into collaboration. This was meant to soften the regime's image by means of employing the unemployed and underemployed poets, writers, artists, critics, and former activists, making them less contentious toward the regime and more dependent on its largesse. He funded cultural institutions, patronized artistic activities, and listened to moderate voices of reform. He was of the belief, at least in the earlier years of his premiership, that with a powerful leader like the Shah at the helm, a necessity in his view, given the painful experience of democracy in earlier years, Iran could be transformed into a prosperous society with material and cultural advancements. His was a positivist view of social progress that paid homage to secular modernism while echoing the Shah's rhetoric. Yet this view did not give any priority to pluralism, popular representation, or respect for individual freedoms. Though Hovedar was sold on the royal rationale of progressive autocracy, he exerted a modifying influence over the system through push and pull, and through persuasion. His self-deprecating demeanour, in contrast to the elite culture of indulgence and arrogance that flourished in the period, was refreshing but not altogether convincing to the regime's critics, or even to intellectuals and activists co-opted by the Pahlavi state. A more significant player of the period was Empress Farah and her fledgling clique of intellectuals and artists who came to dominate the cultural stage in the late 1960s and 1970s. She had a moderating influence on the otherwise monolithic Pahlavi course and its bland cultural perspective. A French-educated student of architecture in Paris when she married the Shah in 1959 at the age of 21, Farah Dibas came from an affluent military family with ties to old nobility in Azerbaijan. A woman of intelligence, with diverse cultural interests and a flair for the recovery of lost Iranian heritage, she was a refreshing voice of refinement in the royal court and beyond. As mother of Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, who was born in 1960, and later as a woman with a taste independent of her husband, Farah Pahlavi earned a stature beyond what was usually permitted or expected of the women of the court. Having influence over the Shah, especially in matters of culture and education, she was also audible, through direct and indirect channels, in the deeply male-dominated political sphere. Having been brought up more as a commoner, she was less alienated from the life of ordinary folks, even though, over time, she seemed to have been discouraged by the prospects for any major reform of the system. Like Hovedar, and at times in cahoots with him, the Empress offered a fresh style, even though she remained essentially complicit in the Pahlavi power rationale. By the late 1960s, the four major branches of power and influence were almost entirely subservient to the Shah. The civilian branch consisted of the court circle under the court minister Azdollah Alam, who also loosely supervised the networks around the members of the royal family, facilitated much of the Shah's relations with the diplomatic corps, and enabled the Shah's private life. The machinery of government and its many enclaves were supervised by the Prime Minister Amir Abbas Hovedar and his ministers and allies. The circle around Empress Farah was smaller in number and limited in its power, but exercised some influence over the broadcasting network. The extensive military branch, consisting of the personnel of the Iranian armed forces, was even more tightly under the Shah's direct control than the civilian branch. He made all the senior military appointments, decided on purchase of military hardware and weapon systems, and monitored the conduct of the ranking officers. Also under the Shah's surveillance, though officially being departments of the government, were the Savak, the National Iranian Oil Company, the Planning Organization, and the Pahlavi Foundation, a charity that held, developed, and operated many of the properties appropriated under Reza Shah, including a hotel chain, as well as managing the Shah's many private investments. Likewise, he personally presided over the most sensitive aspects of foreign policy, meetings with the heads of states and appointing ambassadors to major world capitals. All important, and in many respects not so important, affairs of the state were to be brought before the Shah and received his seal of approval. A category of state affairs that were to receive the royal honour, Sharaf-e-Arzi, was the ultimate stage of decision-making in the Pahlavi hierarchy of power. Beyond the structure of the state and its bureaucracy, which constituted the public sector, those organs of the private and semi-private sectors, which were in routine interaction with the government, including major foreign investments, had to report their economic policies and development priorities to the Shah for his approval. They included most banks, major industries, and universities. In all, the Shah was the supreme source of authority in a power hierarchy that was largely devoid of agency and critical perspective. It was, above all, a system driven by loyalty and obedience to the Shah and fear of him. It is wrong to believe that such a structure under the Shah's thumb was merely for his financial benefit and material pleasure, even though his private life was brimmed with sexual escapades. It is true that, like many autocratic leaders of the developing world, he amassed a substantial wealth for himself and owned numerous private investments and development projects. He also allowed many of his aides, members of his family, court cronies, and ministers to accumulate illicit and undeserved wealth. A powerful clique of businessmen, industrialists, financiers, and developers also benefited from their close ties to the Shah and the Pahlavi elite. There were few major economic projects in the country that could successfully operate without some form of partnership with members of the ruling elite, or paying kickbacks in the form of bribes, commissions, and shares in new ventures. By the mid-1970s, some scandalous deals acquired a level of notoriety even intolerable by the Shah. Yet Iran under Mohammad Reza Shah was not a mere kleptocracy. Far more crucial incentives for enforcing royal control, however, were the two interconnected personal traits in the Shah's personality: a sense of political insecurity and a drive for prestige and glory. He invested a major part of his time and energy to personally supervise and, in most instances, micromanage the affairs of the state, rather than delegating power to his subordinates through constitutional channels. As if he had to prove his worth above all to the ever-present ghost of his father and to ghosts of his nemesis that no doubt included Mossadegh. Prestige, especially on the international stage, equaled in the Shah's mind with Iran's military might, political and diplomatic presence, and projecting unrealistic images of royal confidence and Iran's power and material progress. Such an arrangement endured for more than a decade, especially on the international stage, though increasingly it was corroded from within and challenged by overt and covert forces of opposition, to which the Shah and his lieutenants remained insensitive, if not being in a state of denial. A narrative of ancient glories, and the hurried rush to recapture it, was so blinding that it could not allow any ray of reality to seep through. Foreign policy and regional politics. If there was limited room for other state players in the conduct of the domestic policy, foreign policy basically was the sole domain of the Shah. Relations with superpowers and regional powers were too vital to be left to ministers, advisers, or the diplomats of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In the 1960s and 1970s, Iran's foreign policy aimed to secure Iran's regional interest, especially in the Persian Gulf, while augmenting the Shah's international stature. He remained a staunch ally of the United States and generally a friend of the Western Bloc, while improving relations with the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, and the People's Republic of China. At every turn, he had to prove his loyalty to the West, whether through engaging with the Central Treaty Organization, CENTO, Defense Alliance, making massive purchases of arms, facilitating U.S. investments in Iranian oil and other sectors, and, whenever needed, acting on behalf of the United States and its allies in the region. Over the years, however, he displayed greater independence, even the desire to balance superpowers with his improving negotiating skills. He was also capable of furthering his wishes with the United States and other Western allies, at times even dictating to them, a reality very different from his perceived image in his own country as a docile subordinate of the Americans. In return, successive U.S. administrations, from Johnson to Ford, and especially during the Nixon years, maintained close ties with Iran in matters of security, defense, energy, and investment, despite voices of dissent, for instance George Ball, 1901 to 1994, U.S. Undersecretary of State in the Kennedy administration, who criticized the Shah's autocratic rule in a number of occasions. The U.S. polity and public opinion overwhelmingly viewed Iran as America's indispensable ally in the Middle East and the Shah as a modernizing agent for his people. Friendly relations with Israel also contributed to Americans' favorable attitude toward the Shah, especially after 1973. The Shah's affinity with Israel was primarily grounded in common geopolitical and strategic concerns, but undeniably it helped ingratiate the Shah to his American allies. Iran enjoyed an edge over Israel or Saudi Arabia, the other two U.S. allies in the region. Even after the 1967 war, that greatly augmented Israel's place in American public opinion, from the perspective of U.S. policymakers, Israel was more a costly commitment than a sustained regional power. In the same period, U.S. ties with Saudi Arabia were considered vital, almost entirely because of the Saudis' huge oil reserves, in which the United States had heavily invested for a long time. Even by the 1960s, however, the kingdom's limited demographic and economic potential and its tribal power structure made it an odd ally of the United States. The United States could hardly rely on Saudi Arabia's commercial and military capabilities. Iran offered a different prospect. Its long border with the Soviet Union made it an indispensable first line of defense against the United States' Cold War nemesis. Iran was the only other U.S. ally, besides Turkey, with a common and longer border with the Soviet Union. Finland was considered neutral. Iranian oil and gas reserves were among the largest in the world. In the aftermath of the 1973 October War, the Shah proved himself a trusted ally, unmoved by Arab solidarity. Iran's political stability, though at the expense of repression at home, with a pro-Western leader at the helm who was capable of speaking the political language of the West, was an important incentive to the Americans and to the British. In contrast to the political flux in most of the Arab world and gravitation of vital Arab regimes toward the Soviet Union, Iran's geographical span, growing middle class, and expanding economy constituted the third consideration for the United States. With British withdrawal from the Persian Gulf in the early 1970s, Iran earned even greater ascendancy as the guarantor of security in the Gulf, providing free Western access to its oil resources. Policing the Persian Gulf, which was eagerly embraced by the Shah, became a bone of contention with the newly emerging United Arab Emirates and its supporters in the Arab world. Successive U.S. administrations almost invariably lionized the Shah, both in public and in private, as a capable and sagacious leader, and often paid homage to his international bearing and regional prominence. Even though he was occasionally criticized in the press for his overblown rhetoric, and sneered at in private for his military ambitions and his autocratic grip, the prevailing U.S. position was to support his domestic reforms. His build-up of the Iranian armed forces and his opening up of the country to foreign and especially American investment was another motive. The implicit U.S. approval of Savak's firm hand in dealing with dissidents was further confirmed after urban guerrillas made several assassination attempts in the mid-1970s against the American advisory officers who served in the Iranian military. Despite growing publicity in the American press about violations of human rights, Iranian political prisoners, allegations of torture, military tribunals, and press censorship, American envoys to Iran and high-ranking politicians in Washington were, by and large, willing to turn a blind eye to such unpleasant realities. At most, they treated such issues as an unavoidable evil to be tolerated from a loyal and dependable friend. Even if objections were occasionally raised in private to trusted officials, such as the court minister Azdollah Alam, or to the Shah himself, they were often on specific issues that directly concerned the United States, rather than any cautionary advice about the nature of the Shah's autocratic rule, the excesses of the secret police, the absence of credible elected bodies, press censorship, and the evident disarray in economic policies. These were seen by U.S. administrations as issues related to the internal affairs of a sovereign nation, and hence outside the diplomatic mandate. The Shah and his small circle of key advisers were undeterred in their quest for regional primacy. Even before 1971, when growing oil revenues opened doors of informal diplomacy and influence peddling, the Shah had been able to throw his political weight around in ways that made it difficult for the U.S. administration to downgrade him as a mere despot. In the mid-1960s, he had gained enough confidence to engage in complex international diplomacy involving many players, including the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, the People's Republic of China, and the countries of the Non-Aligned Movement. Neither the United States nor Britain could hold sway over his conduct. During Nikita Khrushchev's years, and continuing under Leonid Brezhnev, despite several spells of intense propaganda wars between Moscow's Persian radio broadcast and Radio Iran, the Shah managed to mend fences with his northern neighbor and its satellites, mostly through trade and manufacturing contracts. Wary of being portrayed as an American puppet, and anxious to display his political agency, the Shah in 1965 visited the Soviet Union, the first visit by any Iranian monarch, to reciprocate Brezhnev's visit to Iran 3 years earlier. He dispatched diplomatic and trade missions, signed numerous deals, often negotiated barter agreements, and established joint development projects with the Soviets and the energy-hungry countries of the Eastern Bloc. The Shah's crowning achievement in 1965 was an agreement to build a massive steel mill complex in Isfahan. Though Russian know-how was relatively backward and hard to fit to Iran's predominantly Western technical expertise, the project was a success. That the acquired Soviet technology was outmoded and polluting did not stop the government from hailing the plant as key to Iran's industrial output, a national aspiration that had remained unfulfilled since a German-assisted initiative to produce steel was abandoned in 1941. In later years, other steel plants with more updated designs were built, as well as a tractor manufacturing plant. Warmer relations with Nicolae Ceausescu's Romania and Josip Broz Tito's Yugoslavia, as well as with Pakistan, India, and China, were also meant to emphasize the Shah's desire to accommodate the non-aligned nations through economic incentives and friendly gestures. In a geopolitical setting still dominated by two contending superpowers, rapprochement with the communist bloc not only helped diminish Soviet pressure, often conducted through the Tudeh network abroad, but also counterbalanced the United States' primacy, and in due course helped Iran in acquiring coveted, sophisticated weapons from the United States. The increasing Pahlavi power in the 1970s ironically reduced Iran's dependency on the United States at a time when the Iranian public perceived U.S. influence to be at its maximum. The issue of arms sales to Iran, especially after 1973, when Iran enjoyed a greater purchasing power thanks to growing oil revenue, from time to time was a source of tension, not so much with the Pentagon or the White House as with U.S. Congress. A number of senators raised questions about the sale to Iran of the latest military equipment, such as F-14 and F-15 fighter jets, on the grounds that it might disturb the balance of power in the region at a time when the Shah demonstrated appetite for policing the Persian Gulf. Iran-U.S. relations, especially resolving their differences, were conducted through informal diplomacy and the Shah's effective lobbying of key policymakers and influential Washington mediators. The Iranian ambassador in Washington between 1973 and 1979, crucial years in U.S.-Iranian relations, was Ardeshir Zahedi. Born in 1928, he was the son of General Fazlullah Zahedi and a former son-in-law of the Shah, who had served for 5 years as Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs. A high-flying player skilled in cultivating personal ties, he acquired the reputation as one of the most effective diplomats in the U.S. capital. Most of the embassy's business carried through private channels, hobnobbing with Washington power elite and with the rich and the famous, including Hollywood stars. He threw extravagant parties in the opulent Iranian embassy, lavished expensive gifts, Iranian caviar was a favorite, on influential deal-makers, and offered other favors to lubricate the wheels of power. His confirmed talents made him indispensable to the Iranian regime and to the Washington establishment. High-level diplomacy in Tehran was no less effective, involving frequent meetings between the U.S. and British ambassadors and the court minister Alam and the Shah himself. Frequent visits to Iran of Western heads of states, prime ministers and foreign ministers were above all to sweeten various trade and economic deals while quenching the monarch's thirst for prestige and recognition. During the Kissinger years, with his shuttle diplomacy, direct channels of communication with the Shah were important for both parties on such breakthrough issues as the Egypt-Israel peace process and the security of the Persian Gulf. Whatever his deeper convictions were, Kissinger's attitude toward the Shah was evidently complimentary, even deferential. His praise of the Pahlavi monarch as a wise, experienced leader with an acute grasp of the complexities of Middle East affairs was based on frequent conversations with him and his ministers, an attitude shared by both presidents he served, Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. That the Shah established all but full diplomatic relations with Israel, collaborating on economic projects and sharing intelligence, added to the Americans' wish to include Iran as a party to the Egypt-Israel peace process, and later to the flourishing of Iran's close ties with Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat. Nixon had known the Iranian monarch since the early 1950s and visited Iran as Eisenhower's vice president in December 1953. He backed the Shah as a stalwart Cold War ally and a friend of the Republican Party. In 1960, the Shah had made an illicit contribution to Nixon's presidential campaign, which raised some controversy, and later, during Watergate, he had commiserated in private with the embattled president. Throughout the difficult years of the Vietnam War, which coincided with the Shah's growing stature as an international statesman, he continued to reap the benefits of being a reliable U.S. ally, defying radical Arab states, helping open up China, and playing a major part in bringing about a breakthrough in the Egypt-Israel peace process. Even though the U.S. public image suffered badly in the eyes of the Iranians and most people of the region during the civil rights movement, and even more so because of the Vietnam War and thereafter the Watergate scandal, the Shah's overall standing was not seriously tarnished by taking sides with the U.S. Republican establishment. It was not without reason that on the day of his inauguration on August 9, 1974, President Gerald Ford wrote to the Shah, with the full support and participation of Secretary Kissinger, pledging his full commitment to the Shah. He added, "In particular, I want you to know of the extremely high importance I attach to maintaining, expanding, and strengthening the very close ties and cooperation between our own two countries. The special relationship between us has been built up through many trials over more than a generation. It has not only stood the test of time, but has grown stronger from year to year. I shall do everything in my power to foster the friendship between Iran and the United States." All in all, despite the domestic disadvantages of appearing to be a junior partner in the Middle East to the West, and despite the Iranian opposition's sour memories of the U.S. role in reinstating the Shah in 1953 and sustaining him for decades in power as an arbitrary ruler, he navigated his difficult course with some success. This task became even more arduous as Iran confronted the potent challenge of the Arab states in the region on strategic and ideological grounds. Facing detractors in the Arab world. Relations with the United States and Iran's foreign policy trajectory more broadly under the Shah hinged not only on Cold War geopolitics, but also on Iran's evolving role in the region as the West's chief ally against the Arab regimes in the contest for supremacy over the Persian Gulf. The Shah's growing confidence and his ambition to be viewed as an international player are well evident in, for example, his conversation in October 1975 with a CIA emissary in Tehran. Responding to the American press's criticism, he defiantly argued that Iran's rising oil prices contributed only minimally, as little as 0.4%, to inflation in the United States. His prime concern was the leftist rise, especially in Europe and the Arab world, which he claimed he intended to combat with money and troops. He moreover criticized the United States in unambiguous terms for not leading the anti-communist campaign worldwide and in the Arab world. Reviewing a range of issues from Sino-Soviet relations and China's rise as a world player, Egyptian ambitions in the Arabian Peninsula, and security of the Persian Gulf, the Shah readily defended his positions on protecting Iran's strategic interests and the survival of moderate Arab regimes and U.S. interests in the region. Through diplomacy, financial support, and military action, which included support for the Barazani Kurdish rebellion against Ba'athist Iraq, and military support for the Kingdom of Oman in combating the Zafar rebellion, the Shah's proactive course was convincing enough for the CIA operative to conclude the following. In summary, thanks to the Shah himself and oil resources, Iran is well on its way to playing a leading role in the Mideast, with a modernized elite, large economic resources, and strong forces. Succession is always a question in an authoritarian regime, even a benevolent one, but each year reinforces the social and political momentum in the direction the Shah has set. I believe the US can keep close to and benefit from this process, and even influence Iran toward a positive regional and world role, rather than a bid for area hegemony or other adventurism. Whether it was hegemony or adventurism, Iran's often strained relations with neighboring Iraq after the 1958 Iraqi Revolution and with Nasser's Egypt throughout the 1960s carried heavy ideological and ethnocentric undertones. Competing Arab and Iranian nationalist ideologies manifested in border disputes with Iraq and regional rivalries with Egypt brought these differences into sharper focus. Almost inevitably, the question of Palestine and relations with Israel came to play a part in Arab-Iranian discord, and both countries came to view their tacit alliance as a natural defense against a common nemesis. What may be called the Arab-Iranian Cold War in the 1960s, which continued in various ways into the 1970s, was largely waged by the states rather than by their citizens. Nevertheless, shared ethnic memories and cultural stereotypes rooted in the distant past reemerged on both sides with vehemence, helping to fuel new ideological and strategic tensions. The Shah followed in his father's footsteps to promote a brand of Iranian cultural nationalism that held Arabs as the ultimate other. Closely tied to the narrative of glories of ancient Iran and the Pahlavi's revival of modern Iran, portrayal of the Arabs as backward Bedouins hostile to authentic Iranian culture was firmly incorporated into popular Iranian nationalist narrative and generally accepted by a majority of Iranians. As a founding member of the United Nations in 1947, Iran had voted against the partition of Palestine and in favor of a federal system whereby both the rights of the Arab Palestinians and Jewish settlers were to be guaranteed. A year later, Iran also voted against the creation of the Jewish state. Yet by 1950, during a volatile period of national politics, Iran offered Israel de facto recognition, largely as a result of the new Jewish state's efforts to win over non-Arab friends in the region. This was at a time when the newly born Israel still projected the image of a victimized small nation that was building a modern society in a hostile environment. The Jewish-Iranian community, one of the oldest in the world, with roots going back to biblical times, supported the initiative, having gradually adopted Zionism since the mid-20th century as a defining ideology and in hopes for a better future. A population exceeding 100,000 scattered throughout urban Iran. The Iranian Jews were economically impoverished and had long been exposed to bouts of persecution in the Safavid and Qajar eras. Instances of extortion by government agents and clerical authorities, the looting of Jewish neighborhoods, the abduction of young women, allegations of blood libel and other illicit acts, harassment and humiliation in public spaces, and forced conversion to Islam were not rare. Added to these were modern expressions of anti-Semitism in the interwar period, mostly sponsored by Nazi propaganda, that were rolled over into the post-war era. Yet the Pahlavi state and most secularized middle-class Iranians entertained a more favorable attitude toward the Jewish community than their counterparts in neighboring Iraq or in other Arab countries in the region. In the post-constitutional era and throughout the Pahlavi period, the economic condition of the Iranian Jews noticeably improved. Many earned higher economic status through education, business, and professional life, though glaring examples of abject poverty also persisted, especially in the depopulated Jewish quarters in larger cities. A distinct accent, sometimes a remnant of Middle Persian dialect of Iran, strict adherence to rabbinic teachings, and a sense of cultural isolation imposed on the non-Muslims by the majority population impeded assimilation. Zionism, an ideology foreign to most non-European Jews, was increasingly embraced by Iranian Jews as an alternative to social isolation or to national assimilation. In the early decades of the 20th century, conversion, especially to the Baha'i faith, offered an accessible channel to religious and social modernity, and in turn facilitated cultural assimilation. From the late 19th century, a large number of Jews of Kashan, Shiraz, and elsewhere converted to the new faith, a non-traumatic break from the strictures of the old religion and from the segregated life of the ghetto. The Baha'i Universalist perspective appealed to the Jews as fulfillment of their messianic prophecies. Yet in contrast to conversion to the Baha'i faith, which meant even more discrimination and persecution in the Muslim environment, even in the Pahlavi era, Zionism promised empowerment by essentially transplanting the Jews, landing them in a Jewish homeland elsewhere, and giving them a new Jewish identity. Throughout the 1950s and early 1960s, hosts of underprivileged Iranian Jews immigrated to Israel and settled there, though many hopes for a brighter life were dashed in the face of harsher realities of life in the new Jewish state. The Ashkenazi elite in Israel looked upon the Oriental Jews as second-class citizens, and the notion of kibbutzim was alien to urban Iranian Jews. Some returned, but the majority stayed and eventually assimilated. Yet insofar as the Iranian-Israeli relations were concerned, the Iranian Jewish community, whether at home or in Israel, played a negligible role. Several factors contributed to the growth of Iranian-Israeli diplomatic and economic relations. Most crucial was Iran's search for security in the face of its Arab adversaries. Iran's membership in the British and American-sponsored 1955 Baghdad Pact, along with Hashemite Iraq, Pakistan, and Turkey, was a search for regional alliance not only against the presumed communist threat, but also against the tide of Arab nationalism, and especially Nasser's pan-Arab ambitions. Egypt's gravitation toward the Soviet Union and Nasser's anti-Iran propaganda alarmed the Shah and his government. During the 1956 Suez Crisis, although Iran officially condemned British, French, and Israeli aggression, it supported the canal's control by an international regime, a proposition doomed from the outset. The crisis, moreover, caused dormant pro-Palestinian sentiments to flare up among the Iranian public. In the aftermath of the 1953 coup in Iran, many dissidents in Iran, including Islamists, admired the young officers in Egypt, and especially Nasser's anti-imperialist stance. For the Shah, who once was married to Princess Fawziyeh, the sister of King Farouk, reigned 1936 to 1952, the fall of the monarchy in Egypt was treated with alarm. 2 years after the Suez Crisis, in 1958, the creation of the United Arab Republic through the Union of Egypt and Syria, which later proved a dismal failure, at the time was seen by many outside the Arab world as a prelude to the greater dream of pan-Arabism, and so a potential threat for non-Arab leaders like the Shah. The success of the Iraqi Revolution in the same year, with palpable pro-Nasserite sentiments, and the brutal execution of the Hashemite King Faisal II, reigned 1939 to 1958, a personal friend of the Shah, brought the message closer to home. The Algerian Revolution, in contrast, which gained momentum during 1958 against French colonial rule, also received positive coverage in the Iranian media and aroused sympathies among the Iranian population. The still inchoate Islamic radical circles in Iran viewed the Algerian Islamists as an admirable model. By the mid-1960s, Israel's cultivation of friendly relations with Iran sharpened Nasser's attack on the Pahlavi regime. Through trade and development projects, as well as the sharing of regional intelligence and defense ties, Iran became a partner with Israel. The regular supply of Iranian oil to Israel, starting in the late 1950s and expanding after 1967, and the joint investment in a pipeline through the port of Eilat on the Mediterranean, further consolidated bonds. The agro-industrial Gazvin Plain Development Project, started in 1962 by an Israeli private firm, was the largest undertaken by Israelis outside their own country. It covered 200 villages around Gazvin, 95 miles northwest of Tehran, and aimed to introduce large-scale drip irrigation methods and conduct other agricultural experimentations. As Egypt further gravitated toward the Soviets, especially after the Eisenhower administration's failure to collaborate on the Aswan High Dam project, Egypt's sensitivity toward Pahlavi Iran as an ally of the US and Israel substantially increased. The Cairo-based Sot al-Arab, Voice of the Arabs, Radio, the mouthpiece of Nasser's regime, was quick to launch a sustained propaganda war against Iran once the Shah admitted his country's ties with Israel in 1960, even though Israel's diplomatic mission to Iran remained semi-clandestine and was never officially recognized. This led to a decade-long break in diplomatic relations between Iran and Egypt. In turn, the Shah had no compunction over accusing Nasser of being an agent of Soviet imperialism and a flighty pharaoh conspiring against his country, harboring Iranian terrorists, and stretching his long arm of Arab radicalism to the Persian Gulf. Growing oil exports in the early 1960s from the Persian Gulf increased Iran's anxiety over the Egyptian and other radical Arab influences in the region. Britain's gradual disengagement as overlord of the former Trucial States, a confederacy of sheikhdoms on the southern shores of the Persian Gulf, now the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, added to Iran's security concern. Once Kuwait, a British protectorate since 1899, gained independence in 1961, Nasser began to capitalize on his pan-Arab popularity to bring the newly liberated state under his wing. He viewed Kuwait as a source of cheap oil for his energy needs and as a foothold for enhancing his anti-Iranian stance. Pan-Arabism, even after the collapse of the union with Syria, still carried enough ideological weight to make the Shah deeply anxious about Nasser's ambitions, and this anxiety would become a lifelong fixation. Nasser's propaganda machine was hard at work renaming the Persian Gulf as the Arabian Gulf, a bogus nomenclature popularized in the face of undeniable historical evidence to the contrary. This was clearly in defiance of Iran's geopolitical interests. The British and American ambivalence toward Nasser, especially in the early 1960s, further agitated the Shah. Nearly all Iranian oil exports were passing through the Strait of Hormuz. Thus, the very financial security of the Pahlavi regime depended on keeping Nasser away from the Persian Gulf. Dispute over the Persian Gulf's nomenclature also carried emotional undertones that went beyond the Shah's detestation of Nasser and came to affect most Iranians. Since ancient times, the term Khalij-e-Fars, Persian Gulf, had applied to the body of water adjacent to the ancient province of Fars. Sinus Persicus in Greek geographical sources, and later Bahr al-Fars in Arabic texts, carried no ideological weight. They simply identified an association with the Persians who lived and navigated the Gulf for more than two millennia. The shift to Arabian Gulf, however, first appeared in the mid-1940s among overzealous British popular commentators. The British were keeping the oil sheikhdoms acquiescent while also tapping their massive oil fields. Hatred of Mossadegh and the Iranian oil nationalization may also have played a part in the curious use of a term with no historical precedence. At the other end of the political spectrum in the 1930s and 1940s, the activities of the Society of the Muslim Brothers in Egypt offered an influential model for Islamic militants in Iran, first for Fadayan-e-Islam and later for the young clerics in Khomeini's circle. Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the future supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, was a great admirer of Sayyid Qutb, 1906 to 1966, the radical theoretician of the Muslim Brothers, and had translated some of Qutb's works into Persian. Yet even in the years after the execution of Sayyid Qutb in 1966, despite his long incarceration by the Egyptian regime, the Iranian Islamist opposition praised Nasser's populism, his defiance of Western powers, and his anti-Pahlavi stance. Nasser's campaign, despite its periodic intensity, nevertheless proved to have some positive impact on the Shah's policies. There was an extra urgency, for instance, to the Pahlavi regime's land distribution and other reform measures throughout the 1960s to compete with revolutionary land reform in Egypt and Iraq. Facing domestic and regional challenges, both secular and Islamic, it was not unreasonable for the Shah to display greater signs of religiosity. In 1968, he made a well-publicized pilgrimage to Mecca, where he performed all the Hajj rituals with great humility. A year later, he attended a conference of the Islamic heads of states in Rabat, where he played a crucial part in founding the Organization of Islamic Cooperation.